Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. We have an incredible docket today. You are not going to want to leave until you hear all of it. All right, first, the prosecution responds to Mark Means' allegations about Lori Vallow calling the Mormon church. Wait till you hear the response. The Ghislaine Maxwell trial continues. The Jesse Smollett trial continues. The Alex Murdoch matter is getting real personal between the attorneys. The Josh Duggar, rhymes with hugger, trial is getting ready to begin. Kim Potter, we'll talk about that trial. You'll know the facts when we talk about it. Could Bill Cosby go back to prison? And then our dumb criminal of the day. It is Tuesday, November 30th, 2021. We've got a very large docket for you today, but it is worth you sticking around for the entire thing. The first thing we want to talk about is the response filed by the prosecution in response to Mark Means' motions that he filed regarding Lori Vallow calling the LDS church, the Mormon church, and basically seeking counsel and things to that effect. Well, the government does not hold back on anything in their motion. Basically, they just lay it out there that Mark Means is, in using their words, not mine, it's in a motion, unethical, over the top, and basically sanctions should be imposed. It was almost as though I had written the motion, because everything that they talk about, I mentioned when we talked about the motion that was filed a couple of weeks ago, and I'm telling you, a little suspicious, and I thought, huh, where's Mr. Archibald in all this? Well, the prosecution makes note of that as well. So as you may recall, the attorney for Lori Vallow, Mark Means, he's kind of been there from the beginning, he filed a motion for violation of Brady violations, motions for criminal depositions, motions for out-of-state subpoenas, and motions to disqualify the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. And I said, well, I don't think the states violate any Brady rules. Criminal depositions are only taken when, in fact, people's deposition or when their testimony needs to be preserved, like they're going to die. Maybe they're being in the military and they're being shipped out overseas. And then the out-of-state subpoenas. Well, the court in Idaho has no jurisdiction over anybody in Utah. Pretty much law school 101 procedure. And then the motion to disqualify the Department of Health and Welfare. Very creative indeed. And the prosecution agreed with my assessment. Maybe the prosecution's been watching Crime Talk because I could have written this motion. Their first response in regards to the Brady material. Now remember, Brady material is anything that is exculpatory. Okay, the government, pursuant to Brady v. Maryland, it's a United States Supreme Court case in 1963, and it basically says that the suppression by the prosecution of evidence favorable to the defendant upon request is a due process violation where the evidence is material to either the guilt or innocent or punishment, irrespective of good faith and bad faith of the prosecution. What does that mean? It means the prosecution has to turn over everything, good, bad, and ugly, whether it helps their case or not, but it has to be within their control and possession. So statements that are made to a third party, the government has no obligation to go and get them. So if Lori Vallow allegedly calls the LDS church and makes statements, those are not within the control and custody of the prosecutor. They don't report to them. If those statements were made to the police department, the prosecution should have to go and get them. But apparently in this particular case, the prosecution says, you know what? We were made aware of some statements. We turned them over immediately. And so basically they say, Mr. Means, go back to school, learn what a Brady violation is instead of just throwing out allegations. And they also say the obvious, that Mr. Means can go and talk to these individuals. And I don't know how many times we've talked about this. In the civil world, everybody wants to take depositions. In the criminal defense world, you don't get to do that. You hire an investigator, you get in your car, you go fly to see somebody, and you go knock on their door and see if they'll talk with you. And most of the time they do. But it seems as though nobody's doing any investigation like going to actually talk to these people. Now remember, every witness can say we don't want to talk with the with either side. They basically will say we'll see him in court, but you don't get to request depositions. And really, this is the blow that I think is quite obvious. And I mentioned this early on when Mark Means starts filing these motions. I said, where is the co-counsel? Why is he not joining in this motion? Well, the DA's kind of basically lay it out for you. He says, the potential for harm to Valode Bell by publicizing such statements is high and could be extremely harmful to Mr. Means' former client, Chad Daybell, who is a co-defendant and alleged co-conspirator in this matter. The DA then says, it is noteworthy that Valo/Daybell, court-appointed death sentence qualified public defender, has not joined in this motion. That's right. Mr. Archibald, the experienced criminal defense attorney, is not joining in these motions whatsoever. I would love to be a fly on the wall when Mark Means and Mr. Archibald meet. And the prosecution is not wrong. I do not know why Mark Means is still on this case. He said in open court that he not only represented Lori Vallo, but that he represented Chad Daybell. He said in open court, why is he still on this case? I have no idea why, but he's there, and so we do that. The next argument was the depositions, and basically the prosecutor's outline for Mr. Means, go to Rule 15, and that's to depose in order to preserve testimony for trial, not just because you want to go interview somebody. Go interview them. And basically it also states that the court cannot subpoena anybody out of the state of Idaho. Simple facts, simple rules of law. Mr. Means needs to start reviewing the law before he starts filing motions. And they go on about disqualifying the Idaho Department of Health and Public Services, and basically says the court is not going to get involved in doing anything along those lines. I think the prosecution is totally correct in this analysis completely. The prosecution sums up and basically says there's no evidence to support the declared motion filed by Mr. Means, that Mr. Woods has never, ever met alone and spoke with the attorney from the LDS Church. The conversation regarding this issue apparently lasted approximately 1 minute, and Mr. Wood informed the said attorney he would notify the defendant's public defender. Mr. Wood immediately contacted the defendant's court-appointed counsel and informed him of such information. And this is where it really gets good. The prosecutors say Mr. Means' continued representation of the defendant is inappropriate and unethical. Mr. Means has an unwaivable and unethical conflict of interest due to his past dual representation of both Lori Vallo and Daybell and her co-conspirator, co-defendant, Chad Guy Daybell, in regard to the subject matter of this case. Mr. Means' continued involvement in this case is inappropriate and creates issues for appeal. An inquiry into the conflict must be held in this case, and a knowing, intelligent waiver of conflict on the part of the defendant must be waived. Mr. Means' continued involvement in this case is inappropriate and creates issues for an appeal. An inquiry into this conflict must be held in this case, and a knowing, an intelligent waiver of conflict on the part of the defendant must be made in order for Mr. Means to ethically represent Vallo Daybell. However, an inquiry and waiver cannot occur due to the defendant's restoration commitment and related stay on this case. They go on to say further, any waiver, even if knowing and intelligent, should be rejected by the court. An incompetent defendant should not be presumed to have waived the constitutional right to conflict-free counsel, especially when said counsel appears willing to publicize private statements of the defendant. At a minimum, Mr. Means should be precluded from filing any other documents in this case that are unsigned by his co-counsel until such time as the court can engage in inquiry with the defendant regarding the conflict of interest. Ouch! Ouch! This is what I have said all along. Mark Means doesn't know what the hell he is doing in a respectful way. And I think it is clear to everyone that is familiar with the law. The DAs sound like they've finally had enough. They're pulling out the conflict card, which frankly should have been raised early on in this particular case. And I love that basically they say Mr. Means shouldn't be allowed to do anything without adult supervision in this case. Can't disagree. Cannot disagree. He's never tried a felony case. He is completely in over his head, and he should be removed from this case immediately. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. I said it. Oh, that's right. I said it, I think, a year ago when there was a conflict where he said he represented everybody. So
The amount of resources that can be saved in order to allow that to happen, and given that I represent her husband, Chad Daybell, in the event that there's an issue there.
Mr. Means, have you ever represented any of the alleged co-conspirators that are set forth in the criminal complaint?
No, Your Honor, other than Mrs. Daybell.
Not trying to say that I was correct a year ago, but, well, I think I said what everyone should have been raising before. I think they were trying to play nice. Clearly, the prosecution is done with Mr. Means, and they're going to get rid of him. He should just go away. All right. Next on the docket, I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, we've been waiting for all these trials for the last year, and they're finally happening. Well, Ghislaine Maxwell, that trial has started. Trial started yesterday. Now, the U.S. attorney, Laura Pomerantz, basically said in her opening that Maxwell and that man named Jeff enticed girls as young as 14 to engage in these so-called massages, in which sex abuse came to be seen as casual and normal after vulnerable victims were showered with money and gifts. Now, the prosecutor sought to make clear to a jury of 12 that there was no confusion about whether Miss Maxwell, that guy named Jeff's longtime companion, was his puppet or an accomplice. The United States attorney said that she was in on it from the start, and the defendant, Miss Maxwell, and that guy named Jeff lured their victims with a promise of a bright future, only to sexually exploit them. Now, Miss Pomerantz added that Maxwell was involved in every detail of that guy named Jeff's life, and that the defendant was the lady of the house. And even after Maxwell and that guy named Jeff ended their romantic relationship, the two remained the best of friends. Now, the prosecution stated that Maxwell was there to help normalize the sexual abuse by making the underage women feel safe by taking them shopping and asking them about their personal lives. Now, when United States Attorney Pomerantz finished, Attorney Bobby Sternheim said her client was a scapegoat for a man who behaved badly, just like so many women all the way back to Adam and Eve. She said she's not that guy named Jeff. She's not like that guy named Jeff or any other powerful men, moguls, and media giants who abuse women. I wonder who she could be referring to. Now, Sternheim said the four women who would testify against Maxwell recruited them to be sexually abused were suffering from the quarter century old memories and the influence of the lawyers who guided them to get money from a fund set up by the guy named Jeff's estate. Now, the defense did something very interesting and is called the rule of three. And I love coming up with the rule of three because juries love it. And the defense basically said this is a case about memory, manipulation, and money, okay? Three things, the rule of three, three M's, memory, manipulation, and money. Rule of three, psychologists will tell you that people can only really think of three things like snap, crackle, and pop, right? Who doesn't remember that stuff? By the end of it, those jurors are gonna hear nothing but memory, manipulation, and money. And that is their theory, that is their theme that they are going to work through every one of the victims. Now let's talk about it. The women that are gonna be the witnesses in this case. And if they were sexually abused, my heart goes out to them. But the defense attorneys in this case have a job to do. And they're gonna say, oh, so let me understand this. They gave you the promise of hope of a career, money, flying around in private jets when normally you're living in, say, your double wide trailer and you're broke and you come from a broken family. So they're offering you this world. And with this world, you were asked to participate and you knowingly and voluntarily did it. And now you're crying wolf when basically the party was over and you didn't get any money about it. So you cried wolf and said that you were abused. And whether you were actually manipulated by the attorneys to guide you through this process to get money will come out on cross-examination. So remember that, the defense theme, memory, manipulation, and money. Now, the first witness that was called for the prosecution was the private pilot for Epstein, who basically said that that guy named Jeff, well, he was the number one, and that Miss Maxwell was the number two. Basically, it was used to introduce some logs, as well as photographs of all the places that they would fly back and forth, basically probably to show, wow, look at this rich guy. He thinks he can get away with anything. Oh, and she participated in it as well. So there you go. We'll bring you updates on that. I'm telling you, I don't know what's going to happen. All right. More than likely, she's going to be convicted, but you just never know. All right. One of the prosecutors is an individual by the name of Comey. That's right. The daughter of James Comey, the former head of the FBI. And a lot of people have sent me stuff saying, oh, my gosh, it's a big conspiracy. I don't buy that. I think she's just there trying to make a name for herself like any young prosecutor would. But you have to think, people keep saying, are there going to be so many people that are worried about her testimony? I don't think so. Yeah, she may have a little black book, but guess what? She's made it rather clear. She's not talking. And all the people that were on the plane, guess what? It's not relevant to the charges here. These women are alleging that that guy named Jeff did bad things to them with the assistance of Miss Maxwell. So whether it was famous people, maybe former presidents that were on the old Lolita Express, probably not going to come in at this trial. There's always an exception. Depends on somebody who opens the door. But bottom line is, it just, I don't think it's relevant. All right. Hey, so we got more to go on the docket. A lot. But if you haven't done so already, like the video, subscribe if you haven't. And quickly, let's talk about Crime Talk Prep, okay? They help keep the lights on here in the Crime Talk studio. And as you have seen in the world, you never know what's coming next. And if you go to crimetalkprep.com, you can get your 3 months of an emergency food kit. And if you hit the link, you'll get $100 off. You never know what's going to happen. You need to be prepared for the unknown. And so bottom line is, have an emergency food kit for you available and your family. It'll be the best decision you've made. And I'm telling you, it's like insurance. You hope you never need it, but it's good to have when you do. You just never know what's going to happen. Go to crimetalkprep.com. Get your emergency food kit today. All right, next on the docket, the case of Jussie Smollett. Now, the former attorney for the Empire actor, Jussie Smollett, argued that his client was the victim of a legitimate crime despite evidence from the prosecutor stating that Mr. Smollett had staged the crime himself. Smollett's defense attorney told the jurors that the prosecution team was going to lie to your face about the facts of the case. Can't believe the court let him say that on the record. That's a little bit beyond a roadmap of what you're going to hear the evidence to be. Needless to say, the prosecutor stated in his opening statement that he would prove that Smollett and his attackers were working together. And when he reported the fake hate crime, well, that was a real crime. The prosecution stated that the plot arose because Smollett was reportedly upset at how Empire's parent studio, Fox, had handled his receiving of a racist letter with Trump's MAGA slogan drawn on it. Webb added that he wanted the jurors to see surveillance video and still footage from the night that Smollett was attacked. One of these still shots will show Smollett still walking into his apartment with a sandwich after the alleged attack. Despite the evidence, the defense attorney argued that Smollett's planning the crime himself was illogical because the brother's story, the twins that beat him up, was unreliable and full of holes while Smollett's was sound. At the end of the day, they both argued that they want you to believe that Jussie Smollett was stupid enough to pay for a hoax with a check, but was smart enough to pay for supplies with a $100 bill, his defense attorney argued. The defense also stated that he believed a third attacker may have been involved in the beating, and an eyewitness report taken by a Chicago policeman may corroborate this claim. That's what we talked about the other day. Buried deep in the discovery was one person saying that there was somebody out there that looked suspicious and had what they believed to be a rope. Now, the brothers, who are the alleged fake attackers, are two men from Nigeria, but the eyewitness stated that she saw a white man at the scene that night. The defense counsel also countered that the allegation that Smollett had perpetrated the attack to get back at Fox Studios, stating that the actor had actually declined additional security from the studio. We'll see how this trial progresses. Unfortunately, there's no cameras in the courtroom, and so we'll just have to bring you the information as it becomes available. next on the docket, Alex Murdoch. I'm telling you, this thing is getting crazy down there in South Carolina. It has become personal, a personal war, that is, between the state senator, Dick Harpootlian, and Satterfield's family attorney, Eric Bland. Now, after filing a motion last Monday asking for a gag order and the sanctions against Bland, the defense attorney, Harpootlian, has taken matters into his own hands and is going after Bland's license to practice law in South Carolina. That's right. The defense attorney had filed a formal grievance with the South Carolina Supreme Court's Office of Disciplinary Counsel that accused Bland of misconduct. Specifically, he's alleging that Bland has violated the South Carolina bar rules of professional conduct for pretrial publicity. Bland responded by saying he does not want to start a war with Harpootlian, but he added, "I think he is one of the best lawyers our state has produced. He really is just representing a client that he can't use his skill to get them off or mitigate the heinous nature of the stuff that he's done." So in their November 22 gag order motion, the defense and his co-counsel, Jim Griffin, argued that Bland's comments to the press are interfering with Alex Murdoch's right to a fair trial. Murdoch's attorneys, both of whom have been fixtures in the national media coverage of their client, argued that Mr. Bland's comments are designed to prejudice a potential jury in the favor by publicly impugning Murdoch's character. Now, Murdoch is currently being held without bond at a Richland County Detention Center and faces 32 charges for insurance fraud, filing a false report, theft, money laundering, computer crimes, forgery, and obtaining goods by false pretenses. Ladies and gentlemen, attorneys need to act with more respect for their fellow co-counsel. Don't get me wrong. We all have met that other opposing counsel that is just a complete jerk. But you don't run off to the bar until the end to grieve somebody, okay? And I tell you, that's not done very often, because at the end of the day, when the emotion is done, you realize the other side is just doing their job to zealously represent their client. And rarely does it come to the point where they have crossed that ethical line in which they have done so. So everyone needs just to take a deep breath over there for sure, and let's see how things shake out. Next on the docket, that's right, Josh Duggar rhymes with hugger. Well, his dark past was publicly detailed for the first time Monday in some emotional testimony hearing just ahead of the trial. And the trial involves possession of minors. All right. Now, Duggar has pled not guilty and has vowed to fight back in the courtroom. So back in March of 2003, Josh Duggar had something to confess. This was just a few weeks past his 15th birthday and a few years before his family found reality TV fame from the TV show 19 Kids and Counting. Well, behind closed doors, however, Duggar had admittedly fondled younger girls since the age of 12. And Monday's three-hour hearing in court in Arkansas turned on what may be a key matter at his trial later this week, whether or not the judge should admit the evidence that Josh Duggar has previously committed inappropriate sexual acts. Duggar's defense maintains that Monday's testimony about his actions two decades ago was not definitive. The only major factual dispute at the hearing was about the extent of the conduct and not whether any alleged acts occurred, because Josh's illicit history first burst into the public in 2015 when a tabloid published the police report from 2006 about an investigation regarding these inappropriate acts. And these inappropriate acts, well, apparently included Duggar's sisters. But none of that, his defense insists, should be relevant today. The prosecution pressed two witnesses, including Josh's dad, Jim Bob Duggar, over what Josh had admitted to them years ago. The defense argued that Josh's statements were made in the context of spiritual counseling with Bobby and Jim and Holt and should be shielded by the religious privilege between clergy and parishioner. Judge Brooks, who questioned Justin Gelfand about where such privilege would begin and end, including in the context of mandatory reporting laws about child abuse, Judge Brooks requested further briefing from both prosecutors and the defense by Tuesday. Because why? Jury selection was beginning. The other witness was a gentleman by the name of Bobby Holt, whose husband, Jim Holt, has known Jim Bob Duggar since they were kids. The Holt's oldest daughter dated Josh for several months back in 2002 and 2003. One day, the two might actually marry. Now, Josh and the Holt's daughter stopped dating because of an incident that happened in March of 2003. Jim Bob called Jim Holt to invite him over to discuss what Josh had done. The Holt's and Duggars spend hours at Jim Bob's place, and the group apparently prayed. Now, Bobby recalled that day that Josh telling her that he touched four girls on their breast and genitalia as a pattern of behavior, she said, and from when he told me it started at age 12 until March of 2003. Now, under cross-examination, Bobby said she had kept no records of what she said, Josh told her, but pushed back when the defense focused on her failure to remember what words Josh used for genitals. I know what he told me, she said. Now, Jim Bob Duggar was also on the stand, and unlike Bobby, Jim Bob avoided giving almost any specifics on what Josh had told him of the past alleged molestation, beyond describing that it was inappropriate touching of girls. Now, Jim Bob repeatedly said, I don't remember. It's been like 18, 19 years, been a long time. Jim Bob also confirmed in his testimony that problems continued. There was, yes, an incident that he told us about after the first incident. Now, in 2003, Jim Bob said an incident made them send Josh from their home. They said they tried to handle things in-house. It was a very difficult time for our family. He did not elaborate further in his testimony. Both Josh, Jim Bob insisted something had crossed the line at that age of curiosity at 14. Your hormones are kicking in. So we'll have to see. Jury selection has actually started for the case of Mr. Josh Duggar. One of the potential jurors showed up, apparently as some sort of cousin. So needless to say, he was disqualified. Now, the judge has an important decision to make on this issue. Every defendant is allowed to be tried on these charges and these charges alone. It's what they call 404B evidence. And 404A says, basically, bad character evidence doesn't come in. 404B says, well, if it shows absence of mistake, pattern, modus operandi, then it should come in. But it has to be articulated for a very specific issue. Frankly, if I was the judge, knowing what I know about this case, I would say, don't bring it in unless the defendant testifies and said, I would never do anything inappropriate. Why? So that there's not an appellate issue in the case. Frankly, it sounds like the evidence that's going to be introduced about the items found on Mr. Duggar's computer are going to be overwhelming for the jury, and therefore, why create appellate issues for the defense unless the defendant testifies? And I don't think he's going to. We'll just have to wait and see. All right, Kim Potter. Do you remember that name? You may not remember the name, but the facts you might. She's the former Minnesota police officer, Kim Potter, who shot and killed 20-year-old Duante Wright, who was a young black man during a traffic stop in April of 2020, and she's charged with first and second degree manslaughter. Well, jury selection begins today, which will decide her fate, whether she goes to prison or she's justified. And as the police chief made a statement at the time, said that Potter meant to use her taser. Remember that? She meant to use her taser, but she grabbed her gun. Well, both Potter and Chief Tim Gannon resigned after Wright's killing, and the Brooklyn Center City Council fired the city manager. In both cases, we're dealing with recklessness and negligence. And for the first degree manslaughter, that means that there's an underlying offense. In this case, they're alleging misdemeanor mishandling of a firearm. For the second degree manslaughter, they're just stating that it is reckless or extreme negligence. So for the second one, they would have to show that Miss Potter was extremely negligent when she did the act. For the first degree, they would have to show that she was not only negligent, but also did an underlying crime, meaning the misdemeanor handling of the weapon. The city has said that it has since implemented measures, such as identifying space for peaceful protesting, utilizing space and distancing to de-escalate tension in the protest area, and adding patrols from outside law enforcement agencies. The city council is also debating reallocating more than $1 million from the police department toward policing reforms. Now, Ms. Potter, I think it's going to be a tough day for her. I think that she's going to be found guilty of something. It is clearly negligent that she didn't know the difference between her taser and a firearm. Huge, huge difference. Don't feel the same, not in the same location. She made a big mistake, one she's gonna have to live with forever. She's certainly not gonna possess any firearms anymore if she's found guilty of a felony and may actually be going to prison. All right, Bill Cosby, remember that guy's name? That sounds familiar, doesn't it? Well, the prosecutors handling his case have filed a petition with the United States Supreme Court to ask them to review the ruling that overturned Bill Cosby's 2018 sexual assault conviction. The prosecutors are arguing that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's June decision sets a dangerous precedent with far-reaching negative consequences. Now, in a press release, the then district attorney of the Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, a guy by the name of Bruce Castor, said his office would not charge Mr. Cosby for the crimes because there was not enough credible and admissible evidence. Castor later said he issued the statement in an attempt to prevent Cosby from invoking his Fifth Amendment right and refusing to testify if he was sued in civil court. Cosby did testify when he was sued in civil court and admitted to giving the women drugs before sexual encounters. So in the petition filed with the United States Supreme Court, the Montgomery County District Attorney, Kevin Steele, said that it would set a dangerous precedent to honor press releases from district attorneys as binding guarantees of immunity. Prosecutors argue that district attorneys often use similar language in press releases and that Cosby overturned sentence could lead other convicted people to claim immunity under that precedent. One of those people may actually be Ghislaine Maxwell if she was found guilty, because in her case, when the U.S. attorney dismissed and said, let the state prosecute that guy named Jeff, it went all the way up to the United States Attorney's Office. And one attorney office was bound not to prosecute. And then they reneged on that and basically said, the Southern District of New York is going to prosecute Ghislaine Maxwell. Now, here's the issue. I don't see what constitutional argument the prosecutors are making that the Supreme Court would think that we need to do this. I'd be surprised if the Supreme Court took this case up on a writ of certiorari. Understand, on a writ of certiorari, it's a petition or a request for the Supreme Court to look at the case. About 2% of the cases, 2%, okay, where cases are filed with a petition for a writ of certiorari to the Supreme Court, actually make it to the court's docket, okay? Most of them don't even make it to a conference where the judges, the justices, think about taking the cases, okay? I recently had one that went up. It made it to conference, but guess what? Denied. So, very tough. I can't believe the Supreme Court would take this one, but hey, you never know what the Supreme Court is going to do. And finally, next on the docket, our dumb criminal of the day. Michelle Stilwell pled guilty to a pair of criminal charges in connection to an unprovoked act. According to the criminal complaint, Stilwell was in the backseat of her Uber ride when she reached forward and proceeded to choke the victim, the Uber driver, from behind. Now, as the victim tried to pull over, Stilwell managed to crawl forward onto the center console and bite the victim deeply on the neck, drawing blood. Now, in the plea deal, Stilwell admitted to battery and disorderly conduct and was sentenced to 18 months of probation. Stilwell, a licensed practical nurse, was also fined $850, directed to undergo a mental health evaluation in order to have no contact with the 23-year-old victim, Michael Hasse. While police and court records do not cite a motive for the attack, arrest affidavits note that Stilwell displayed an indication of an alcohol influence. Shocking. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's all we have for you today. Please join us live tonight, 6 p.m. Mountain Time. You know the drill. If you haven't subscribed already, do so. Hit that like button. Make sure you hit that little bell so you get notifications when we go live or put up new content. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.